everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Catherine Jellison on the show, and we'll be talking about her terrific new book, It's Our Day, America's Love Affair with the White Wedding, 1945 to 2005. I myself had a white wedding, and I remember even at the time thinking how it was rather odd that my wife and I were playing at Lords and Ladies. We're modern people. I'm a modern man. She's a modern woman. We're both successful professionals. She's more successful than I am, but I don't begrudge her that. Yet nonetheless, despite all of our good liberal credentials, we were dressed up like Prince Charles and Lady Di. Not exactly, but something like that. I thought it was odd at the time, and I imagine she did too, although much fun was had by all. Like I say, I didn't really understand it, but now I do, because I read Catherine's book, and we should thank her for writing it. She does a terrific job of explaining how this peculiar institution weathered the storm of ideological change and social change through the post-war years. The White Wedding is, in a certain sense, our mirror, and we should, again, be very happy that Catherine showed it to us. So I really enjoyed talking to her, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine.
You are in Ohio, is that correct?
That's correct.
That is correct, yes. I suspect that the weather there is much like it is here. That is cold.
It's very cold, much colder than it usually is mid-November.
Yeah, I should tell our listeners that we have Catherine Jellison on the show today, and we'll be talking about her terrific new book, It's Our Day, America's Love Affair with the White Wedding, 1945 to 2005. While we're on the topic of the Midwest, since you're in Ohio, I really liked the fact that in the acknowledgments to your book, you had some words of praise for the beautiful landscape in the Midwest. That was very, very, I always appreciate that, being a native Midwesterner myself. So kudos to you. Although I won't encourage people to move to the Midwest. We like it just fine here. So anyway, if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up and where you went to school and your mentors and how you came to write your previous book and this book, we'd really appreciate it.
Okay, Marshall. Speaking of the Midwest, I am a native Midwesterner. I grew up in Kansas, actually in a part of Kansas that many people probably don't think of as the Midwest, but the West. I grew up in western Kansas in a town called Hays.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was an administrator at the Regents institution out in that part of the state, Fort Hays State University. So I grew up a faculty brat, and we had a lot of conversations about history growing up around the dinner table, and growing up in a place where there was a lot of history from the Homestead Act period and the so-called Indian Wars period after the Civil War. Going around to museums, and when we would take family trips across country, stopping at places like Lincoln's house in Springfield, mm-hmm. Illinois, etc. We were just a family that talked about history a lot, believe it or not. It has dinnertime conversation, and my maternal grandparents, for most of the time I was growing up, just lived down the street, and both my mother's father and her mother were very interested in history and liked to do the same kinds of things on vacations as my parents, which is, you know, stop by state historical society sites or national history sites. And so it was just something that was a part of my growing up experience. So I had always been interested in history, and as an undergraduate had a double major in history and English at the aforementioned Fort Hays State University.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to, I earned my master's degree at the University of Nebraska, so mm-hmm. I stayed in the Plains States and pretty much thought I would focus on 19th century women's history, and wrote a master's thesis about the history of the YWCA there in Lincoln, Nebraska,
mm-hmm.
and decided to go for my PhD elsewhere, and that had a stronger program specifically in U.S. women's history. And, of course, my PhD mentor, Linda Kerber, who is a professor of history at University of Iowa, was one of the names that I sought out in terms of leaders in the field of U.S. women's history. And I did apply to other programs, but of the programs I applied to and was accepted in, Iowa was definitely the most attractive in terms of whom I would be working with as an advisor, and also the assistantship package. So some more Midwestern boosterism here. It was an ideal graduate experience. I'm so glad things worked out the way they did. And while I was there at the University of Iowa, I took a research seminar my first semester there with Shel Stromquist, who is also still a professor there at University of Iowa. And it was a seminar in U.S. social history, and he really acquainted me with the archives there at the State Historical Society of Iowa branch in Iowa City. And I followed up my interest in 19th century women's organizations by doing research in papers there at the Historical Society dealing with the Women's Christian Temperance Union there in eastern Iowa. And I, in casting about for a dissertation topic, I went in to talk to my advisor, Linda Kerber, and said, well, I suppose I'll keep going with these topics that I have investigated in the past in my master's thesis and in the research seminar with Shel, you know, women in 19th century women's organizations. And she started in that Linda Kerber probing way asking me what had attracted me to women's organizations of the 19th century, what particularly attracted me to the 19th century. And her questions, as we went on in this conversation, became more and more skeptical. And so we took the conversation in another direction, and she liked the idea of looking at rural women, because one of the WCTU, Women's Christian Temperance Union, chapters that I had looked at was in a small farming community there in eastern Iowa, and I said I enjoyed that research very much. So, and I knew there were many materials available there in Iowa City for doing research on rural women, 19th or 20th century, and, well, especially now, since my time there at Iowa in the 1980s, there is now Iowa Women's Archives, too. But at that time, there were available to me there in Iowa City just some things at the library's special collections, and there at the branch of the Historical Society, but lots of things, farm women's letters and diaries and papers from rural women's organizations and this kind of thing. And so Linda and I really latched on to the idea of sticking with rural women as my population. And then the more we talked, we moved up into the 20th century, and probably a couple of conversations down the road, I started talking about maybe the way adoption of the automobile changed rural Midwestern women's lives. And then maybe within another couple of conversations, we broadened that to general 20th century technology, transportation, household technology, and communication technology. And so I ended up writing a dissertation that was entitled To Power, Farm Women and Technology, 1913 to 1963, which became my first book in the Gender and Culture series at the University of North Carolina Press. And I certainly did end up using a lot of the materials available to me there in Iowa City, but Linda also encouraged me to apply for fellowships elsewhere, and I broadened the geographic focus to the Midwest in general, back to the topic of the Midwest again, and ended up going to archives throughout the Midwest, and eventually applied for and received a pre-doctoral fellowship at the Smithsonian Institution to be based at the National Museum of American History, and which is conveniently, it has recently been refurbished and opening for the first time in 2 years, but it's still at the same location, although with spiffier digs than when I was there. Now, after this major rehab, it's in great proximity to the National Archives building, which at that time, in the late 80s, included Department of Agriculture materials. Now, those have since been moved to the new facility in College Park, Maryland. But at that time, I could do my research over at the Museum of American History and then walk down the mall a ways to the National Archives. And I also did research there at the Library of Congress. And so that was an invaluable experience. It was interesting that a lot of the materials that originated in the Midwest actually ended up in Washington, D.C., letters from Midwestern farm women to, for instance, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, surveys by Department of Agriculture agencies that included answers to the survey questions by Midwestern farm women. And then another component of that research was going out and doing oral histories, which was my first acquaintance with that kind of research. And this, again, is the late 1980s. So women who had survived the Great Depression and World War II on the farm, which were a couple of key eras for technological change, and of course, disruption in typical farm family life, a lot of those women were still alive and healthy and able to be oral history narrators for me, and those were great experiences. I feel that in some ways I was there at the right place at the right time, because in the 20 years since, of course, that generation has, many have passed from the scene. One of the oldest women I interviewed had been born in 1903 in a sod house in Kansas. And of course, I'm sure she's no longer with us. She was the daughter of Exodusters, former slaves from the South who had moved out to Kansas in the late 1870s to take up homestead land in what they considered the promised land. And being a native of Kansas, I can make the joke. And you know what? They thought the promised land was Kansas. And, of course, I would agree with that. I think most people, that wouldn't be their vision of milk and honey life out on the Great Plains in a sod house. But so I had some really interesting experiences doing that dissertation, which became my first book. And with Linda's guidance, I really felt I had a first-rate experience in using archival sources. I also had a mentor at the Museum of American History, Pete Daniel, who is currently the president of the Organization of American Historians, so another very prominent American historian. And he was so helpful in guiding me to appropriate archival sources there in the Washington, D.C. area. And so after that experience of the dissertation slash book, I felt I really knew how to approach an archives, knew how to be a detective, if you will, in the archives. And this experience in doing oral history research also was, with the first book, was so beneficial to my experience then doing research for the second book, because I relied again to a great extent on oral history research and archival research. And something else I'd done with the first book, which is look at a lot of the prescriptive literature in the farming magazines, in reports from the Extension Service telling farm women what they should be doing and what they should be buying, mm-hmm. and discovered a gap between the prescription and the lived reality. So it was those same sorts of categories of evidence, oral history evidence, archival evidence, prescriptive literature evidence. Those were probably my three main categories of evidence that I used in the second book. And then in addition to that, something I wasn't able to indulge in the first book because of because of the nature of the topic. In the second book, the use of pop culture evidence, movies mm-hmm. and television programs and internet sources. Of course, when I wrote the first book, the internet basically didn't exist for most of us. So, I had some new experiences with the second book, but certainly my experiences during the research and the writing of the first book laid down some important patterns for the way I approached the second book topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should say that I didn't know you were from Kansas, because I'm from Kansas, too.
Oh, where are you from?
Yeah, well, I'm from, actually, my people are from Chase County, which is in the Flint Hills, and I grew up in Wichita.
Okay.
But I spent some time in western Kansas, usually hunting pheasants.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever did any of that, but I did a lot of it when I was young.
Oh, my gosh. My dad, he's now disabled and can no longer do these kinds of things. But when growing up, he was a pheasant hunter par excellence.
Yeah.
So I never went on those trips, but I was often at home when he came back from them, and my mother had about 1,000 different recipes for Kansas game birds,
exactly.
And quail and doves,
yeah.
And I remember the mud I was there when he'd come home from those experiences, so I know something about the aftermath.
I used to, before I was actually able to hunt myself, I was always assigned the task of cleaning whatever had been killed. My end of the stick, and it was a short end, I have to tell you. Just one quick question.
Sure.
Since I'm just a little bit, I've always been curious about, you mentioned these African-American homesteaders in Kansas, and I know this is a little bit off topic, but while I have an expert, I kind of want to ask.
Okay.
There's a place called Nicodemus in Kansas, right? And I remember going there when I was young. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's basically gone now, but is this part of the Nicodemus movement?
And that's the only exodester community that survived into our own time. As you say, it's mostly gone now, but that's why I interviewed the woman I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire town is now is part of the National Historic Site.
Is it really? I didn't know that. Huh.
The entire town, because it's the only surviving exodester community. So that was interesting doing the research there and visiting that community. I guess growing up a couple of times, we had driven through there, probably coming back from visiting somewhere where my dad was pheasant hunting, and the family had gone along, not to hunt, but to hang out with other people, with other family members who weren't hunting. And so I'd driven through there a couple of times as a kid, probably. But that was interviewing that particular woman, who was the oldest resident of Nicodemus, was my only time spending a significant amount of time there.
That's remarkable. Yeah. Is there a good book on Nicodemus? Has somebody tackled this topic?
Yes, there is, and it's probably here on my shelf right now.
Really?
And there's one by Nell Irvin Painter, which I believe the title is just Exodusters, and it includes material about the Nicodemus community. And I'm walking over here to my African-American history shelf. Now, see, my office is not the most organized. That could have ended up on my farm women's shelf, which is at the other side of the room, and I am not talking to you from a cordless phone, but luckily the phone I'm on has a long cord.
This works very well. This works very well on the radio, I would say.
Yeah. There is a book that I'm not seeing right now. I might, while our conversation continues, that is specifically about the Nicodemus community. But a good starting place would be the Nell Irvin mm-hmm. Painter book, and it's just entitled Exodusters.
Mm-hmm.
And then the book I'm thinking about tells about and has photographs of the history of this Nicodemus community, and I do cite it in my first book.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the process by which the town was named a National Historic Site. Anyway, I can't think of the author right now, but as I said, if my eyes happen upon the book while we're still talking today, I'll grab it and give you the title.
Yeah, I just wondered because we have a student here who's studying an African-American mining community in Iowa called Michikanic. I had never heard of Michikanic, heard of Nicodemus, and I'm not an American historian myself. I'm a Russian historian, but
mm-hmm.
I was always interested in it because it seemed like such a strange, maybe not be the right word, a kind of oddity in the middle of Kansas to have this African-American community.
Right, and I think a lot of people back in Kansas, because it is such a small community, might not be familiar with it. There was a book that I think was just called Great Plains that came out in the late 80s by a writer for the New Yorker whose first name is Ian. I can't think of his last name right now.
Don't know.
Anyway, in his travels through the Great Plains, one of the places he stops is, here it is. I see his book here on the shelf. He stops in Nicodemus, and he talks about Ian Fraser.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Fraser is the author, and the title of the book is simply Great Plains.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about his stop in Nicodemus, and he's there for one of their reunion days when
mm-hmm.
people... most people who have roots back in Nicodemus don't live there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, he comes in on one of these reunion days,
mm-hmm.
the only white person there,
yeah.
who meets the children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren of people who used to live there
mm-hmm.
and maybe themselves at one point lived there. So
yeah,
that's another book that has information about
yeah.
this. Community.
It's funny, and I know this is, again, more digression, and we will get to your book in just a moment, but people always think of places like Kansas as very homogeneous, but they're really
yeah,
not.
That's right.
They just aren't. And I grew up two blocks from Temple Emmanuel, and my best
okay.
friend was Rob Cohen, and, there's obviously a historically black section of Wichita, and there's also a historically Hispanic section. It's not as if it's not as if these things don't exist in the Midwest, but the image that you get usually from the East or West Coast press is a place of a whole bunch of white people.
Exactly.
that just isn't true at all. And, as you know from the 19th century, and something I've learned from my Americanist colleagues here is that, in the 19th century, the notion of whiteness itself was ill-formed in the Midwest because there were Germans and there were Scots and there were Irish, and people knew these distinctions very well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they still do in some of these communities on the Great Plains. That is certainly true.
Yeah, it's quite true. So anyway, let's turn to the book at hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like you to begin by talking about something, again, more digression, that's not in the book, but I think the listeners would be interested in it, and I'm sure you know the story of this. What is the origin of the White Wedding itself?
Well, it is popularly attributed to Queen Victoria when she married Prince Albert in 1840. It's not that she was the first person to wear a white dress when she got married. That's probably not the case. But she was the first person whose nuptials were heavily publicized, who
mm-hmm.
had this kind of wedding with a specially made white dress. And the other major components of what today we call the formal white wedding, multiple attendants, a multi-tiered cake, flower bedecked
mm-hmm.
Location, just all of what we now consider the givens of a formal wedding. She
mm-hmm.
was the first person who had this kind of wedding and publicized it to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So she is the person that is popularly considered the inventor of the white wedding.
Mm-hmm. And then it spreads through English culture and makes its way across the Atlantic to America. I mean, does it also spread to the... I don't know how people get married in Europe except in the Soviet Union, and it's quite different there,
mm-hmm.
or the ex-Soviet Union. Is the white wedding now a kind of... Do people, here's one way to put it. Do people in Japan have white weddings?
Yes, they do. In fact, Asia is the fastest growing market for white weddings and the former Soviet bloc as well.
Yeah.
In fact, my first visit to the former Soviet bloc was to the former East Germany in 1994, and one of the first things I saw, I believe it was in Dresden, yeah. One of the first things I saw touring that city was a woman, you know, walking through the streets with her bridal party, having her picture taken in her glamorous long white gown. Yeah, so that was the summer of 1994. And so, yeah, the former Eastern Bloc and in Asia, we see the growing markets for this kind of wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, in Japan, this has been the case for a while, Taiwan as well, South Korea, and now in China.
Mm-hmm.
The typical situation is a traditional Chinese or Korean or Japanese-style wedding, and then a second wedding celebration in the Western style,
mm-hmm.
With the tuxedo, the mm-hmm. white wedding gown. And so when we talk about the expense of formal weddings in this country, it's nothing compared to many locations in Asia where they're paying not only for the white style Western ceremony, but their, excuse me, their own traditional ceremony as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but back to your excuse me, previous question. The Queen Victoria style of wedding was popular in Western Europe and, of course, in Britain and in the United States among members of the elite as the 19th century progressed. I'm going to have to take a sip of water here.
Oh, please do, yes. And let me ask a question while you do. How mm-hmm. common were white weddings prior to 1945? 1945 is the moment at which your book really picks up.
Mm-hmm.
How common were they? What classes of people, what kinds of people?
Well, again, it would be people who had the means to be able to have a wedding like that. So elite people from a variety of backgrounds, if they had the financial wherewithal, they wanted to have weddings like this. And in certain ethnic groups, it was considered the appropriate thing to do, which is, you know, have a rather large wedding that all members of your community participate in and came to as guests,
mm-hmm.
but for people who were not wealthy, what this usually meant was a lot of homemade items,
mm-hmm.
You know, a homemade cake or wedding meal, and music produced by friends and family members,
mm-hmm.
and maybe the wedding dress might be purchased or it might be homemade as well. As the term I use in the book is, for most people prior to 1945, formal white weddings were a patchwork, those who had such weddings, a patchwork of home-produced and purchased items.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of, you know, purchasing all the accoutrements of an elaborate white wedding is something that's very much a post-war phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not original with me. Another scholar came up with this term. The wedding industrial complex
mm-hmm.
only develops after World War II, and it's part of the consumer culture that, as Barbara Ehrenreich says, after World War II, came to crowd out all other cultural possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that a consumer culture hadn't existed in the United States previous to the end of World War II. It's just now more people can participate in it because of the increase in average income after the war. And it's also the era of family togetherness, speaking
mm-hmm.
of the prescriptive literature. All the women's magazines are talking about, you know, we've made it to the Depression, we've made it through the war, now it's time to create the ideal American family life that we have been deprived of all these years. And so family-oriented consumerism,
mm-hmm.
You know, the family vacation, the taking the kids to Disneyland, the, oh, let's, you know, buy a new house in the suburbs, let's make sure that we buy a second car, so mm-hmm. mom can take the kids to all of their various lessons and after-school activities. The amount of family-oriented spending as a result of the prosperous post-war economy, but also because of these cultural messages that are out there, family-oriented spending just goes up dramatically after World War II, and in many ways, the elaborate white wedding is the best example of this kind of family-oriented post-war spending.
Mm-hmm. So then, would you say that, generally speaking, the white wedding was democratized then in the 1940s and 50s? It spread throughout. It became kind of an expectation
right.
for people. Yeah, no, exactly. I see just what you mean. What do the, you know, we don't, yeah, I've been married myself and am married. And you know, I dressed up and we had a white wedding and so on and so forth. I can't say that I understood any of the symbolism. I really didn't. What did people think in the 1940s and 50s as they were adopting this new style of wedding for the first time? Were they conscious of the fact that they were playing a role, or what did they think about what they were doing?
Well, one of my arguments is that this kind of ceremony is perfect for the post-war period, where one of the cultural messages is, again, after the disruption of the Depression and the war, it's time to reassert so-called traditional gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a ceremony that very much plays into those roles, right? You have a woman wearing a dress, especially in the 1950s, the dress style with the big skirt and the cinched-in waist and the neckline that emphasizes the bust. The wedding gown style of the 1950s very much accentuates mm-hmm. the femaleness of the bride's body,
mm-hmm.
accentuates the secondary sexual characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And one scholar has said every woman of this period walked up the aisle a bride, but walked back down it a housewife,
mm-hmm.
regardless of whether she worked outside the home or went to school or what other roles she had in her life. The prescriptive literature says your ultimate role as the American woman is to be the housewife and mother, and take advantage of this opportunity we have to be a stay-at-home wife and mother who can buy all the wonderful products that every American home should have.
Mm-hmm.
So very much the act of even going out and buying the items for the wedding was seen as an introduction to the role of housewife consumer in this period.
Mm-hmm. Now, excuse me.
I'm
sorry. The logistical organization of these weddings of the 1940s and 50s. Now, today, of course, when I was married, I hate to say it, but my wife took care of everything, and with gusto. She did not expect me really to do very much of anything except, you know, help pick the restaurant or something. Was it the case in the 1940s and 50s that the logistical arrangement of the marriage itself was taken care of by the bride and her family?
Yes. Again, the etiquette books and other prescriptive sources said that this is supposed to be what the bride's family does. Really, the bride and her mother and some other members of her female entourage make all the arrangements and you know, are the consumers. But the providers of the resources that the consumers will use will be the men in the family, specifically
mm-hmm.
the bride's father. So the whole ritual around the ritual, if you will, the consuming for the wedding ritual was set up according to female consumer role, male provider role.
Mm-hmm.
And one psychiatrist of the period even said, again, this is a way for a man to reassert his masculinity after the Depression and the war. He's back home, he's in charge of the family, providing for the family, being the family breadwinner. And so, this psychiatrist said, if a man complains about the amount of money he's spending on his daughter's wedding, he's not really complaining, he's bragging.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, this whole ritual and the preparations for the ritual of the white wedding, I would argue, very much set up starkly contrasting gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the bride is wearing a white garment, although this was not in Queen Victoria's time necessarily the meaning of that white garment, but people had come to understand the white garment as a sign of the bride's sexual purity.
Mm-hmm.
you know, that she will not have had sexual experience outside of marriage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, then let's move forward in time just a little bit to the late 1950s and 60s, the moment at which women's liberation becomes an important part of the story. There's some terminology that you use in the book that I wasn't particularly familiar with, and I think that our listeners might not be familiar with either, but I sense that there was a story back there. And that terminology is first and second and third wave feminism. I confess my ignorance about this. I studied the 16th and 17th century, you know, in Russia, so we don't have that. So could you talk just a little bit about those things? Because they powerfully affect the story.
Okay, well, now, these, I have to be the typical historian and give this whole thing a little nuance, and that is that these are problematic terms, okay? And not everyone is attached to these terms or approves of these terms, but they are still largely the ones that are used by historians of American women because they're the ones everyone's familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is debate about whether these are the appropriate terms. So
mm-hmm.
I'll basically define the waves for you.
Mm-hmm.
First wave feminism culminates in the 19th Amendment to the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
giving women the right to vote in 1920, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, although the term feminism is a 20th century term, it is a movement that actually had started back in 1848 with the first women's rights meeting in Seneca Falls, New York.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And the first time that there's a formal call for giving women the right to vote. So we could say roughly 1848 to 1920 is first wave feminism. And then here is one of the reasons why designating the feminist movement as having waves is problematic. It's not that the feminist movement then just, you know, the wave hit the sand and that was the end of it for the next, 45 years or something. There were women who defined themselves as feminists between 1920 and the 1960s and second wave feminism, and there are many ways in which these women acted on their feminism in this time period. So it's not like it disappeared between 1920 and, say, 1963,
mm-hmm.
which is oftentimes used as the starting date for second wave feminism, but we might call it a rejuvenated feminist movement beginning in about 1963.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the Equal Pay Act is signed into law by President Kennedy. That's the year in which Betty Friedan publishes her best-selling book that is a critique of stay-at-home wifedom
mm-hmm.
and motherhood, The Feminine Mystique.
Mm-hmm.
And then a typical way for defining then the end of the second wave is when the Equal Rights Amendment goes down to final defeat in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say general dates 1963 to 1982, because that became, just like the 19th Amendment had been for first wave feminism, second wave feminism had rallied around this cause of an Equal Rights Amendment
mm-hmm.
to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And then third wave would be the period after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so women who came of age, you know, came into adulthood in the 1980s and onward and defined themselves as feminists
mm-hmm.
would be members of the third wave.
Mm-hmm. And we are in the third wave today?
Well, and that's up to debate, too, open to debate. Some people say we're now into a fourth wave, even. And the definition of, first of all, whether or not there is a fourth wave and when that begins is something that's
mm-hmm.
highly debated right now. But again, much of it seems to be tied to my old friend consumer culture,
mm-hmm.
That for women who have come of age now, or let's say college-age students now, who came of age in the 21st century
mm-hmm.
or maybe even the late 20th century, that for them feminism is sort of is very much tied to consumer power, that one is defined by buying the appropriate objects that show one is has earning power herself, has power over her own sexuality. Some people have called it Sex in the City feminism, if you get that picture.
I do, yeah.
Yes. Others, however, say, well, the fourth wave is really much more tied to the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual movement and has rallied around the notion of same-sex marriage being legalized. So, well, maybe you didn't know the can of worms you were opening up
asking
these questions. Yeah, it is very, it gets complex and debatable.
No, I didn't know at all. I find it fascinating. We discuss these issues a lot around my house. My wife is the primary breadwinner in our house. And, you know, we divide child care and all other stuff equally. But it's you know, it's still in the process of being worked out. Even here at the university, it's discussed a lot. You know, we're trying to create gender equality now, which is a kind of it turns out to be a very sticky thing to try to institute. But anyway, let's talk about the second wave then. What impact did the second wave that started in 1963 have on perceptions of weddings and weddings in practice and the wedding industrial complex?
Well, the second wave tried to have a major impact on the wedding industrial complex, and to complicate matters further, there are two branches of second wave feminism, the more moderate women's rights oriented feminism, which was all about, you know, equal pay, you know, public legal rights, this kind of thing. And then the women's liberation or radical feminist branch, which was about redefining what we mean by male and female in this society, recognizing that there's social constructions, masculinity and femininity, and that as social constructions, they can be rethought and remade. So one of the first acts of guerrilla theater by members of the women's liberation branch of second wave feminism occurred at a bridal fair held in Madison Square Garden in 1969. Members of a group called WITCH, Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, invaded this bridal show. They wore black veils as opposed to white veils. They carried placards with catchy slogans like along the lines of always a bride, always a slave, this kind of thing, a critique of marriage, and marriage in a white wedding ceremony that seemed to, as I mentioned before, starkly differentiate gender roles. And particularly, of course, the whole idea of the virginal bride. They also disrupted the bridal fair by opening a cage filled with white mice. And the mice scurried about the vendors and the attendees there at the bridal fair. And so there were attempts by second wave feminists to rethink this ceremony, not only rethink its gender role messages, but there was a huge critique of consumer culture that was part of second wave feminism. And telling women, you don't need to buy the false eyelashes, you don't need to buy the curlers, you don't need to buy all the makeup products that you see advertised in the magazines and on television, et cetera. And you certainly don't have to buy these particular items to get married. And, of course, a questioning of so-called traditional marriage in the first place, which was the kind of thing you were talking about a minute ago, rethinking, well, who's the provider, who's the consumer, who takes care of the kids, who waxes the floor, et cetera. So there were attempts made by second wave feminists to raise people's consciousness about the white wedding ceremony and about the wedding industrial complex, and alerting people to the fact that they could protest the wedding industrial complex and they could be resistors. And there was something by the early 70s called the New Wedding Movement. It was short-lived and never had a huge following, but it was the idea of people trying to organize to resist the wedding industrial complex by making their own wedding invitations, making their own wedding clothes, writing their own vows, and having your reception as a picnic when Abby Hoffman, the 60s radical, married for the second time. He got married in Central Park, and he and his wife, you know, their reception afterwards was everyone lit up their joints and smoked marijuana in Central Park, you know. So there was even, believe it or not, an etiquette book on how to do a new wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And as I characterize it in my book, I call it an etiquette book for marriage-minded bohemians, you know, how to go about writing your own vows that take out all reference to traditional gender roles,
mm-hmm.
How to, you know, make organic food for your reception, how to make your wedding invitations out of, you know, recycled paper and this kind of thing. But at the same time, that weddings like this, like the Abby Hoffman wedding,
mm-hmm.
Make it into the newspapers and receive a lot of publicity in the press and in the era's pop culture, the majority of Americans still weren't resisting the wedding industrial complex, regardless of, well, it's sort of a convergence of second wave feminist ideology and the influence of the era's counterculture as well,
mm-hmm.
really combined to create this new wedding movement. But
mm-hmm.
even though, you know, this idea is out there, most people remain wedded, pardon the pun, to
mm-hmm.
the white wedding. And we see by the early 70s, this book, The New Wedding, is published in 1973, the vast majority of weddings are, you know, formal ceremonies, white gown, father guiding, escorting the bride down
mm-hmm.
the aisle, the traditional wedding vows. In fact, white wedding gowns were more popular than ever. If you go by the sales statistics
mm-hmm.
Gathered by the wedding industry at the time. So the second wave feminist movement, the new wedding movement, didn't end up having much of an impact on the wedding industrial complex.
Why do you think that is?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think because in the late 1940s, certainly through the 1950s and the early 1960s, the white wedding ceremony had become defined by television, by the movies, by the wedding industry itself as the American way to wed. And people had become convinced within a generation's time that this is how you marry,
mm-hmm.
and really seem not to be able to envision something else being a real wedding.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the beginning gay and lesbian liberation movement of the early 70s, and of course these were not legal marriages, they were commitment ceremonies, but the wedding industry was already acknowledging that these could be future customers. Because if two women wanted to have a commitment ceremony, they would still go ahead and get white gowns. Two men, they would rent the tuxedos.
Mm-hmm.
I give lots of examples in the book. Adherence to the Black Power movement might start out thinking about wearing dashikis and, you know, sing their vows in Swahili or something, but ultimately, well, their parents and their friends said, but that's not a real wedding. You got to do it like they do in the movies and on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And as we see weddings sold to us in the department stores. So I just think this democratization, as you said, of the white wedding had become so complete by the late 60s and early 70s, it was difficult for most Americans to imagine another way to do it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I remember in graduate school, I think I read a book or an essay or something by a fellow, a sociologist named Robert Bella, about American, I think he called it civic religion. And this is, you know, when the president talks about God in this kind of nondescript way, it's never any particular God, it's just God. And then, you know, we have religious symbols on our money, and, you know, there's an occasional religious symbol at the courthouse, whether there should be or not. And Bella said that this kind of attenuated, nonspecific sacrality was American civic religion. And I can kind of see the white wedding fitting into that picture, because it does seem as if in the American mind, at least in my mind, that these things go together. If you are in a church getting married, you will be dressed in white, and your husband will be dressed in a tuxedo. This is just the way things ought to be. It's very stereotyped, and it is impossible to kind of think of it a different way of doing it.
Right.
I think that's exactly right. And it really does kind of go to the core of this, of Bella's notion of civic religion. I don't know if anybody reads that stuff anymore, but it certainly occurred to me while I was reading your book. Now, even though the form of the wedding remained largely the same, did the symbolism change? Did the kind of underlying logic of it change? Did people explain what they were doing differently after the second wave?
I think they just... Yeah, well, there was not the expectation that the color of the bride's dress indicated anything about her sexual history or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
There was not the assumption that if a father escorted his daughter down the aisle, he was, you know, literally giving up his protection of the daughter to her new husband's protection, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just became, well, this is what you do at weddings.
Yeah.
And it was not, this is one of the reasons I pursued this topic is my second book. I saw committed feminists, my own graduate students, who behaved on the one day they married so differently.
Mm-hmm.
Out of every other day of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they suspended all the rules mm-hmm. of their everyday life on this one day because, well, it's expected you do these things. They don't mean anything anymore. It's
mm-hmm.
just when you're a bride, you do these things.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to invest it with any kind of political meaning or anything. That's just what you do. And, in fact, one of the books I cite in my book came out as I was just finishing my book. It's called I Do, But I Don't, by a woman named Kimi. I'm not sure if the last name is pronounced Wyckoff or Wyckoff, but she talks about being a feminist who's a member of the third wave. And all of her ideas that she had literally grown up with at the dinner table, because her mother was a second wave feminist, she caved when it came time to get married, and she did all the things that all of her peers expected her to, but then ended up regretting it, you know, getting the white
mm-hmm.
gown. She ended up, I think, with 9 bridesmaids,
mm-hmm.
You know, just incredible. And the fact that I think at this point she lived in New York, her fiancé lived in Los Angeles, and her parents lived in Texas. So all the coordinating of this also meant hopping on a plane
mm-hmm.
quite frequently.
Yeah.
And you know, so this is the amount of money she must have spent on this wedding, well, her family spent on this wedding. You know, this was, she said she had become the person, another person. She wasn't the person she'd been for whatever it was, 28 years,
uh-huh.
Or 27 years. For that one day, she became, you know, this uber bride. And I had seen this kind of thing happen with so many students of her, of my graduate students who would be her peers. And I wondered, what's going on here? Why do these young women think they have to become this new creature and wear clothing like they've never worn before and behave in a way they've never behaved before and do all kinds of things that they've never done before just for this to be a real wedding?
Yeah, it is peculiar, but I think that, you know, I guess I would I kind of want to think a little bit about the way that you put it, which is the way I would probably put it, you know, that they feel they have to. I mean, in the case of my wife and many of the women I know who are all good feminists, they want to do this. They don't feel pressured to do it. They actively seek this out. They want this day to be different. They want to dress up in this way. It's not just a, I guess what I'm proposing is not just, it's not a, it's not an expectation that they bridle against. It's an expectation they embrace to a certain extent.
Yeah, but I guess my argument would be, but they didn't make it up themselves.
Oh, no.
You know, they've been getting these cultural messages for all these years that, you know, creates that want. So we're back to the consumer culture again. But, and I do think that one way, and that's interesting, Marsha, that you asked that question. I think if we're talking about members of, for instance, the third wave, it's oftentimes discussed in a manner of it's my day to celebrate myself. It's a day to do something special for myself. It's a day where I can be the center of attention and give some messages about who I am. You know, make this public declaration of love for this person I'm marrying, but also show I have, these are my certain tastes, you know, in menu, in bridesmaids wear, in bridal wear. And increasingly, of course, women are paying for these events from their own pocketbook or sharing the cost with their fiancé. And so it has, it also may say something about, well, here's my level of professional achievement. I can afford to do something like this. So I think in that way, my answer to your earlier question would be, yeah, there are some new meanings attached to a white wedding. But it's not sort of taking the old ideas about virginity and paternal protection and all of that and putting a new spin on that. It's almost as if those ideas aren't even considered at all. But it is instead taking certain meanings that previous brides would have never even thought about, you know, these meanings of empowerment and showcasing my identity, my individual identity. I think those are some new meanings placed on the white wedding that brides a generation or two ago would have never even, it wouldn't have been anywhere on their radar screen.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that completely. Because, you know, I remember when we were arranging our wedding that it really was about our self-expression. And we, while we were working within a certain genre or a series of tropes or a form, we were adjusting those tropes and forms in what were really kind of minor ways, but we invested a great meaning in them, you know, like where we chose to eat and what we chose to say as if anybody would ever remember it, what sort of officiant we had. You know, the whole thing was really about us presenting ourselves to this community. And I also just say, interestingly, you mentioned about all the plane flights and things. Having been to a lot of these things, you know, we like to think of weddings as this moment where this community of people come together to consecrate these vows. That community exists for about one day.
Yeah.
Then they fly home, and that's it. No more community.
It's not like these earlier weddings I was talking about when it was literally the community surrounding you. I think of one of the weddings that I well, I was going to say I discussed in the book. I don't think I do. I think it was in an earlier article I wrote where the woman was the daughter of German immigrants. This is between the two world wars. And she said, well, you know, we never sent out invitations. Everyone just knew if you were German, you came to the wedding. The English never came to our wedding, and we never went to theirs. And, you know, she talked about that she and her mother did go to a department store and buy her dress, but, you know, her mother and sister made all the food, and people, you know, who had musical skills played the music, you know, from the community. It was just, well, this is literally your community. It's your ethnic and religious community. It was the German, local German Lutheran community back in the Midwest again. This was in Nebraska. And literally the community, the physical community that surrounded this bride and groom. I mean, these were their neighbors. And so now we've taken this concept to, as you say, sort of the one-day community idea.
It really is. I mean, I know that, you know, in weddings that I've been to and also my own wedding, you know, there were people that came that I was told I was related to them. I'd really never seen them before, but I was told that they were my relatives, and then they disappeared, and I don't know where they are now. I was happy to receive their gifts. I should say one thing, that one fascinating part of the book that we haven't really had a chance to talk about, and we don't really have time to talk about, but I found really interesting. And also a little bit, in it, so some of the kind of hyperbolic presentation is positively, and I'll be a little editorial here, embarrassing. Like your description of the Michael Douglas, Catherine Zeta-Jones wedding, that was just... how could they think that that was anything but embarrassing? I mean, the degree of falderal that was involved in it, it's astounding to me. I don't know. And also another thing that you talk about, and I always wondered about this, and I thought it was much older than I learned, and that is what we call the mergers and acquisitions page in the New York Times, where people announce their weddings. Could you talk just a little bit about the genesis of that?
Oh, well, there's always been, you know, a society page where elite people, you know, socialites, would announce their engagement and their weddings. Now it has, they still tend to be pretty well-to-do people that show up in the weddings and I think it's called weddings and celebrations now, because some of them are same-sex commitment ceremonies, or if it's in Massachusetts or Connecticut, they're real weddings. In terms of having legal standing. But, this has become, beginning in the early 1990s, almost an extended advertisement for the wedding industrial complex. People, by the old society, I'm picturing like all these old movies where, you know, there's one woman who works for the newspaper and she's the society editor, and there's a little form that people have to conform to. You know, you can only spend like three sentences describing the wedding gown or something like this. But typically now these announcements of recent weddings and celebrations go into great detail about, you know, who designed the gown, what caterer, you know, did the banquet, and of course, because these do tend to be not, you know, the old social register crowd from the 19th century, the early 20th century, but people of some accomplishment. And they tend to be, you know, some of them from wealthy families now, but more members of the meritocracy, I've noticed.
That's absolutely right. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I used to kind of play this game with my wife who went to Harvard, and I'd say, we'll look in the mergers and acquisitions page of the New York Times, and we'll look for classmates of yours. And inevitably, we found one or two.
Yeah, because they now go into great detail, and this shows that the new bride, you know, she also is not just someone who's setting up housekeeping somewhere.
She's a trader at Goldman Sachs.
Yes, she has a very high-powered career, has had a high-powered education. Usually all the schools are listed in the degrees, and yes, the firm she works for, et cetera. And then this vows column that started in the early 1990s, which features, you know, one wedding in sort of, you know, a whole page to itself, or a big portion of one page. You know, it's like the featured wedding of the week.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, we'll have what's called wedding photojournalism. It's not just a picture of the bride and groom together, but a couple of shots of them at the wedding. You know, either one I remember is someone who'd worked for the Clinton administration when Bill Clinton was president, a picture of, you know, Madeleine Albright and the bride and the groom and both Clintons, you know, they're all shaking hands and hugging in the reception line, you know. It's highly illustrated, and the story of the whole courtship and you know, how they chose the location. And it's usually, you know, a very upscale location where the wedding and reception are taking place, but sometimes it has a novelty aspect to it. For instance, one time a couple that was featured in the vows feature got married in a Kinko's office because that's somewhere where they could teleconference their wedding to friends and relatives who lived all around the country, or a couple who had met jury duty, you know, getting married in the same courtroom where they had sat as members of the jury together. But usually it's, you know, those are the atypical ones. Instead, the weddings that are featured tend to be people of healthy income who mm-hmm. have spent their healthy income on very elaborate weddings.
Yeah, no, I guess coming to conclude with another note about the Midwest, I remember when I was growing up, there was a kind of social register, but it was more like the Jones went to the Smiths for Sunday dinner. Do you remember those?
Right, certainly do.
This is miles from that.
I certainly do. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
and I always wondered, who thinks... You know, because my family would never do those kind of things.
Yeah.
But I'd read the Smith and the Jones and think, what makes them think that that's so important that they
cares.
Have to call it into the paper?
Yeah, I don't know, but they did it. I remember it quite well. Anyway, we have taken up a huge amount of your time, and we could talk forever about this book. There are parts of it we didn't even get to. There's a great chapter about celebrity weddings, and there's another great chapter about movie weddings. I highly counsel people to look at the book. There are also some really wonderful photos from your own collection that they're just I think they're priceless, and they really add a lot of value to the book. I just looked at them with fascination and showed them to my wife. So as I say, you know, thanks very much for being on the show. Let me conclude in our traditional way, and that is to ask you, Catherine, what you're working on now.
Well, I've decided what I really am is a historian of gender and consumer culture. Mm-hmm. You know, both my books I've written so far deal with that topic, and the next one is about Old Order Amish women in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania in the mm-hmm. 1930s and 1940s. And you might think, well, these women, where do they fit into consumer culture? But they are people who are consumers, but in ways that are atypical. And in their atypical lives as consumers, they are seen as appropriate role models for other women during the years of the Great Depression mm-hmm. and during World War II. And it's mainly going to be a book about how the federal government and the state government in Pennsylvania uses the image of the Amish woman to a certain extent with Amish women's own cooperation as sort of the role model for women in times of crisis, economic and wartime crisis, because they are women who are already recycling, and they are women who already have victory gardens, for instance, although they don't call them that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the subject of many government studies and publicity campaigns
mm-hmm.
about how to be a good Depression era and wartime era wife and mother and housekeeper. And it's particularly interesting in the war years because they are members of a religion that that are pacifists.
Right,
they're
exactly.
non-resistors.
Yeah.
And yet
that's
they right. are used as a wartime symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war, with the growth of this family-oriented spending I've been talking about, the women themselves are consumed by the growing post-war Pennsylvania mm-hmm. tourist industry. Mm-hmm. Oh, go see the Amish women
right.
making their quilts
yeah.
or at their roadside stands. So
mm-hmm.
it's really fascinating stuff.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great book, and we hope that you come on the show when you're finished with it to talk to us about it.
Oh, thank you, Marshall.
All right. Well, Catherine, thanks very much for being on the show. The book is It's Our Day, America's Love Affair with the White Wedding, 1945 to 2005. And Catherine Jellison, thanks very much for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me, Marshall.
Sure. All right. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Catherine Jellison about her new book, It's Our Day, America's Love Affair with the White Wedding, 1945 to 2005. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week. Thank you.